listening to a podcast from DCT Audio. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been producing audio content for over 10 years. Thank you for listening to this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. Well, I'm delighted to say that I've been joined today by Nick Garnett, who's a former BBC journalist with many decades of experience. Welcome to the podcast, Nick.
Thank you very much indeed. It's good to be here.
I suppose what I do with all my guests, really, is just a little bit of history about yourself.
Right, so I'm from Liverpool. I lived a very, very standard, bog-standard life. I didn't know anybody in broadcasting at all and didn't have any intention of going into broadcasting at all. We didn't have any journalists in the family. There was nothing like that at all. And I started doing some acting at school and thought that I was the best actor that you've ever seen in your life and went away to college to do acting. And when I got there, on the first day that I was on the course, I went in, and I didn't know this at this point because they hadn't done it yet, but I was surrounded by people who were going to be in every Harry Potter film, who were going to be with Clint Eastwood in films, Sean Connery. There were people from Mark Thomas, the comedian, was there. It was like absolute creme de la creme. And then there was me. And I was rubbish. I'd been in school plays. And so I went to the guy that was running the course and said, you know, I need to leave. I'm just not up for this at all. And he said, don't throw it all in now. Have you thought about doing something else other than acting? I said, well, what do you mean? What can there possibly be apart from acting on an acting course? And he said, what about sound? So he started to get me into sound and lighting. And I started recording the soundtracks for plays and things. And from that moment on, every play that was at the college, it was a 3-year course, and every play that went had the biggest sound productions going. There was, like, you know, every sound effect that you could possibly imagine, every bit of music that you could possibly bring into any program. You know, it didn't matter if it was Shakespeare, there'd be, like, whatever, heavy rock or anything like that, or at the it was the 1980s, so it was like Madonna tracks and things like that, coming into Shakespeare. And I just sort of like took over on the sound. And after I left college, I went and became a lighting director of a theatre company in Cornwall. And then in that wonderful way that happens, I'd done some work experience at a commercial radio station, Radio City in Liverpool, but nothing had really happened with that. But in one of those wonderful ways that happens, it was actually my mother walking round. She was a teacher. She was walking around the playground with another teacher. And the other teacher said, oh, yeah, I'm married to the news editor at Radio Merseyside. And my mum went, can you get my son in? So I went and started working for free at Radio Merseyside for about 8 months. Didn't get any money at all. I was signing on the dole. And it was very, very strange because, you know, sometimes you go into the dole office and your voice would be on the radio and things like that. It was just a bit weird. Eventually, I started to get more work and more paid work, and then I got a job and started working in radio stations. But I wasn't a journalist at that point at all. I was a presenter because I'd always wanted, let's be honest, I wanted to be a rock god. That's what I wanted to be when I was growing up. And I failed miserably at that. But when I was being a rock god, I also looked at the DJs and thought, you know, the DJs, that they have a career that lasts years, whereas musicians have a career that lasts 3 minutes, 25 seconds, and then they may never be heard of again. You know, there are lots of bands around full of people who've been in A Flock of Seagulls or something, or someone that nobody's ever heard of since. And I didn't want to be that person. I wanted to be the DJ. And that's why I went into presenting, became a radio presenter. And then after a few years, I did some more maths in my head. And I was working up in Middlesbrough in the northeast at Radio Cleveland. And I realised that there were 5 programmes during the day on the radio station. So that meant there were 5 presenters at the radio station. And I extrapolated this out and thought, OK, there's 34 local radio stations in the BBC. There's 5 presenters at each station. That's not a lot of jobs. Meanwhile, there's hundreds of journalists, because in the newsroom, there were 20 journalists. So there were 4 times as many jobs in news as there were as a presenter. And so I jumped ship and I got retrained through the BBC's internal system and ended up in Lancashire, in Blackburn at Radio Lancashire. And I was here for 4 years and I loved the place. I thought, you know, I don't think there's anywhere in the world like Lancashire. Lancashire is a fantastic place. If you tried to get so many different communities into one piece of land, you couldn't do it. There's nowhere else in Britain that's like it. It's the most bizarre county that there is. You've got the east of the county where God, life is hard. It's, you know, I was with the farming community. It was the hardest working farmers that you've ever seen in your life there. And then you've got sort of like the middle band, the Blackburn Bank, which is fantastic for news stories, is another way of saying it, because there's so much going on there as well. And so that was a really good place to be. And that was where the radio station was based. And then you had Preston, which was so cosmopolitan. It was fantastic. It was a city life. And then you had Lancaster out on its own, which was amazing. And you got Heysham and you got Morecambe. And then with all of that, it would have been, life would have been perfect, because that is like everything you could possibly want in a county. And then you put Blackpool into it. And Blackpool should be like, I think, should be like the Vatican. It should be a country in its own right, because it has everything that there is in there. You could, if you get bored of life, just go to Blackpool, because it's just got everything. And, you know, I have to say, my wife doesn't really love Blackpool as much as I do. I would go there and I would live there in a second. I think it's the most brilliant place on earth, because it's so much fun. It's a fantastic place. So that was me in Lancashire. I was a reporter. Then I got picked up by Network Radio. When I say picked up, I pestered until they allowed me to go and work for them. And I joined Five Live. And I was the North of England reporter of them. And I did that for about 25 years. And honestly, until the day I left, I kept thinking they were going to find out and say, well, we're going to stop paying you because you're just having fun. And I was. And for 25 years, it was fantastic fun. It was brilliant. It was just amazing. I went all over the world. I saw things that nobody else sees. And then I went into TV and I like became a TV correspondent as well. And then I decided basically it was time to leave. I didn't want to get so old that I couldn't do anything else. And I wanted to be able to go and do other things. And so that's what I'm doing now. So that's sort of my life.
Wow. What sort of things are you doing at the moment?
At the moment, I'm doing some training with people. So I'm doing some work, hoping to do some work with the BBC's charity arm, the BBC Media Action, which works in communities around the world. So it's in Eastern Europe, it's Central Asia, in the Far East as well. And it's about storytelling, and it's about empowering people to be able to tell stories. So the BBC has this charity and they want me to go and help them out, hopefully. My attempts to leave the BBC didn't really work, because I got pulled straight back in to go and do some documentaries for Radio 4, which was fantastic fun and really, really, really exciting to be back making proper crafted radio that really, really you could spend time working on and polishing it. And that was fantastic.
Well, that's interesting, because for people that are in the industry, obviously you've worked previously for the BBC as an employee, and now you're working for the BBC as a freelance. Is there any, what are the differences, and what sort of creative opportunities does it give you that perhaps as an employee you wouldn't have had?
People would say it gives you the freedom to say no. I haven't had that luxury yet. I keep going, yep, I'll do that. Yep, I'll do that.
Which is what you do when you're freelance.
Yeah, exactly. You say yes to everything and then worry about it afterwards. What has it given me? It's given me the chance to step back a little bit. And this sounds really sort of like quite negative, but it's given me the chance to actually look at what I did in my career and go, dear God, that was a good job. Because one of the things that's really amazing is that I've noticed this for a long time, that people will say, how come you got a story about everything? And it's because you do so much travel in the job. And when you leave the job, you don't do that much travel. So, you know, stupid things. I'd say, you know, someone would say, Hull's horrible. And I'd say, no, it's not. Look at Beverley up the road. Beverley's fantastic. It's the most gorgeous place. And you know, look over Grimsby. Grimsby's got a great market. It's good. You know, it's got wind farm technology as well that's coming out of there. It's really, really coming. And I would know a little bit about an awful lot of places. I haven't done as much travelling around since I left the Beeb. And I really, really miss that. But it's made me appreciate the places that I did go and see. And then, so I've started writing all that down and sort of like writing down little stories about things that happened. And there are hundreds and hundreds of stories, but I'd like to make some new ones as well.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you're really passionate about, we're talking about your work and the previous things that you've done. You mentioned that you started off your career looking to go into acting. And I suppose as a, not so much perhaps a journalist, because you're dealing with facts, but as a presenter, how much of that?
Oh, I mean, I keep saying, oh, you know, going and doing acting, that was waste of time, you know, and it wasn't the course that I should have done. But actually, It's what creates you. It's what, you know, it's about that storytelling thing, isn't it? That, you know, everyone talks about having a personal narrative in a story and telling a story about something that relates to you. And the great thing is that so many damn things happened. You know, I went to, I think it was like 38 countries in about 18 months. It was just crazy. I know that at the time, every country I went to, I sort of paused and thought, I'm going to take this in. I'm going to actually appreciate this and understand this, because I'm very, very lucky to be in South Sudan. I'm very lucky to be in the Central African Republic and to see a country that I don't know anyone else who's ever been there. And to have that, that is a really ace thing. And so in some ways, that drama experience, that presenting experience, and the being aware of where you are and how you fit into things, that I've brought that with me. But, you know, you're right. In terms of acting, you can't really act the news. It gets back to facts and facts and facts.
Well, it's interesting you say about visiting 38 countries, and you mentioned Blackpool earlier, and I know Blackpool intimately because I worked there for nearly 30 years, and perhaps my view and outlook of Blackpool would be different to yours, but I have a professional working view on Blackpool. So when you're travelling to these other countries and you're busy working, do you get that opportunity to just switch off and actually see the country through your own eyes, I suppose?
That's a good question. I always try to give myself some time off or to stay an extra couple of days. I mean, sometimes that's difficult if it's in a dangerous environment. But even when you don't do that, I think that experiencing parts of what is the human and the normal life around there is really important. I mean, the Central African Republic, most people don't actually know where it is. It's near DRC. It's been in a civil war for 20 years now. It used to be a French community and a French state, as it were. It's not pushing it to say it's a failed place. There's been so many problems. And yet, it's still a place. There are people there. There are, you know, there are schools there. There's help coming in. And it's just fantastic to see and to be part of something that, as I say, that you wouldn't normally see and you wouldn't be party to. And then you do all that in somewhere on the other side of the world. And then you come back and you suddenly find yourself in Lancashire, and you find yourself in an area that you didn't know about Lancashire, and you can do the same things there. And I think that very much it's about what you do as a person, whether you involve yourself and you, as you say, you take time to actually look around you and to appreciate. I always think that, I mean, there have been so many stories where you camp out as a journalist. You just go to an area. So a tragic story, but one that rings a bell, is the Nicola Bulley, the missing woman in Lancashire. And we were there for probably 2 or 3 weeks. And you get to know the small area where you're working really, really well. So there was an area in the village where she was last seen. There was a church there. There were a couple of shops. There was a garage down the road. And these places, suddenly, at the end of all of this, of you being involved in a story, they become a bit like home. And you know those areas. And it really annoys my children, because I'll be driving around with my kids and I'll say, oh, and they go, what happened here? There was a murder there. And then, oh, I remember there was an abduction over there. And then, and all my stories relate to bad things.
Do you know, that is so true. I can drive around Lancashire. I'm exactly the same. Oh, that was a fatal there.
Yeah.
That was a murder there.
Yeah.
It's odd, isn't it, how traumatic events become landmarks.
I can still remember what the woman in the village in North Yorkshire was like when she opened the door and there were 25 reporters all wanting sandwiches that morning and she only had three. You know, all those sort of little things that happen. And you just remember it. It is a very strange way of...
Now, I've got to ask you, because I've been in sound production for about 10 years and I'm dabbling with it. You've been a professional sound producer for 30-odd years, I'm guessing. What I found when I first started out was I hated listening to the sound of my own voice. And it took me probably about a year to get over that.
Right. So what happens with that? It's when you start talking, when you're talking to your partner or talking to anyone, you hear the reverberation in your head. You don't actually hear what your voice sounds like. And yet there is a moment. And we all hate it when we suddenly go, oh, my God, is that what I sound like? That sounds terrible. But then there's a moment where your brain tricks in and your brain switches it over. And actually the voice that you hear in your head, the reverberation, is the voice that comes out of your mouth.
Well, that's interesting.
And you start, and it just takes over. What I'm trying to say is that your brain is so clever that it will balance out things, and that's what happens with your voice.
Well, if we can talk a bit about mobile journalism, Mojo. I mean, I think probably considered to be one of the pioneers in that.
Yeah.
What exactly is it?
Right, so what happened? Let's go back to how it happened. What used to be the case is that a reporter in radio, a reporter in newspapers carries around a notepad. A photographer carries around a camera. And yet what you've got is you've got a radio reporter has to carry around their own tape recorder. And the tape recorders we used to use were reel-to-reel tape machines.
Wow.
And they weighed the same as a newborn baby. And you had it on a very, very thin leather strap that was on your shoulder. And it used to really cut into your shoulder. It was horrible. Also, the reels of tape only lasted 15 minutes. The batteries only lasted 45 minutes before the battery was dead. So then you were carrying around a newborn baby with no batteries, so you couldn't use it. It was rubbish technology. And I really, really got fed up of this. This is one of the beauties of working in the BBC. I would pester somebody and say, let's buy one, let's try it. So I tried a thing called Mini Disc, which nobody will remember now. We had some little recorders and they were great because they'd fit in your pocket. They were fantastic. That was about the size of a mobile phone in your pocket and it would record. And then there were other little bits of technology as well. But that meant that I could now start to move around. And I didn't have this blasted thing dragging on my shoulder and running out of battery every 45 minutes. And I could work for hours and hours on end. And then, of course, lo and behold, the smartphone arrived and the smartphone changed everything because all of a sudden I had a recording studio in my hand, in my pocket. And the things that you can do with it are absolutely amazing. I mean, everyone knows that phones have got cameras and everyone knows that they've got audio recorders and everyone knows that you can type on them as well. But you can also record whole radio programs on them, mix them all together. I once did a documentary and a podcast series about Mohammed Salah. And I did the whole thing from start to finish on my phone. And I went all around the world, went over to Egypt to where he was born and into Cairo, working all over the place in Anfield as well, where you'd never be allowed to take big tape recorders in. And I had my phone, of course, everyone had their phone, but I was using it to its full potential and could record these whole programs. And it's still transformatory. It's just amazing. And now, in the last sort of like 4 or 5 years, you've brought in video work into that as well. So the cameras on the very latest iPhones and the latest Samsungs are so good that we can use them for broadcast TV. And a few years ago, we started doing live broadcasts over phones on radio. And I was in Stockton-on-Tees one day and there was a flood. And I was on one side of the flood and my satellite truck with my camera crew were on the other side of the flood and we couldn't meet up. And I thought, what the heck can I do? And I phoned a couple of people and they told me that they were working on something that was just some future technology. They said, quick, download it. So they sent it to me. I put it onto the phone. I was able to broadcast and do a piece from the flood on my phone. And that was the very first time that it had ever been done. You know, it's using the same technology that the police, I'm sure the police in the UK do it, but I know that the Mounties are using exactly the same thing as a comms device and to be able to send back quality pictures from the scene of an incident straight back into the control room. You know, it's groundbreaking technology, but it's in a phone. It's in a 500 quid phone. It's just fantastic. It has changed completely. It has changed not only the way I work, but it has changed the whole of the idea of news. And more than that, if you look at where we are as a society, people might not like it at the moment, but we're in an area where everybody can broadcast using this thing because everyone's phone is exactly the same. And that causes all sorts of trouble. And I didn't know when we started on this journey that it was going to cause those troubles. But if you look at the rise of citizen journalism, if you look at, again, looking at what happened with Nicola Bulley, with the so-called journalists who came and broke their way into the news conferences, this is all as a result of what happened with mobile journalism, that what it did was it enabled everyone to be able to record and broadcast and publish material that they never had that chance to before. I don't think you can ever put the genie back in the bottle. I think we're in a position now where that's happening all the time. And it's moved on from there. It moved on from mobile journalism and the ability to create. It moved on to social media and the madness that's in social media. And that's really, that's yesterday's story now, because the real story is what's happening with AI. And we've got to embrace those changes as well. So journalism is changing. And if you look at the pattern of how it's gone mobile journalism, social media, AI. God knows what's next.
You and I are quite lucky in that we've lived through a revolution, which is the digital revolution, I suppose. It has changed the way we view the world. And the internet was groundbreaking enough, but you're right. It's how I think once we got the smartphones and how we access the internet, that was the big game changer for me.
If you think what happened, it used to be a situation where the only people who had communications were people who had shortwave radios or radio communication systems like the emergency services, and we had people with mobile phones. Now, I remember in 2000 texting a girlfriend on a mobile phone, and text messages, of course, were never designed and never created to send messages to one another. They were for engineers to be able to send little loopback messages from about mobile phone networks. And that's what they were designed to do. And that's why it was so stupid that if you wanted to type I love you, you had to place what number would it be? 1, 2, 4. You had to press the number 4 three times.
Yes.
So an I. Then you had to go a 0 for a space. And then you had to go on to whatever, JKL. So that would be number 5. You have to press that three times. And then number 6, you'd have to press three times as well for the O. And it was impossible to actually do it that way. But we did, because that was where we were in, 25 years ago. Now we're at a stage where everybody can send whatever type of message they want.
You can talk into your phone, it'll send
exactly.
a message.
There's a real danger that people of our age are the ones that think that they are the gatekeepers of this, and we have nothing to do with it at all. And the digital natives, which is anyone under 30 now, they're the ones that control all this, and we are merely the bystanders, we are the outsiders. We have no idea just how much people can do. And if you look at, I've got a 15-year-old daughter, and if I look at what she's doing, she is doing 3 or 4 things at the same time, on different networks, communicating with different communities. So whether it be her school friends, whether it be friends from, she plays hockey, so she's hockey mates, and she's doing all of these things at exactly the same time. And we are so out of date, and we will never, ever catch up with them. All we can do is try to run alongside them and be party to what's going on.
It's interesting you mentioned that about your daughter, because there was a piece on the radio the other day, and I think Claudia Hammond has just recently written a book called Overwhelmed, about just this saturation of news and information, and just as human beings, we're just not equipped to take on all this information.
Yeah. And I think that the way that people are dealing with that is that there are younger people. I've got a 27-year-old son who really doesn't engage with the news at all, and there's me screaming, going, you've got to be involved. You've got to know what's going on. It is your job to know what is happening to society. And you only do that by reading about the news or watching the news or listening to the news. So you just don't want to know.
Mm. Well, I've got two sons at 32 and 28. So you've got some kids yourself. And I do wonder, hopefully, and yourself with your life experiences and mine, that everything we view and everything we listen to is viewed through a lens of perspective. And I'm just wondering whether the current generation have that perspective.
I don't think they do. I think that they get it and that they will pick up on things. I'm just utterly delighted that my two girls, a 15-year-old and 18-year-old, they're now really starting to engage, and they're really involved politically, and they're watching what's happening in the world, and they have views about it, and they are taking it up. Maybe it needs the chaos that we're in at the moment to actually engage people, and it's because things are so extreme at the moment that they are getting involved, and they are involving themselves in what is happening.
Now, you mentioned mobile phones, and now everybody is a reporter. Everybody is a journalist. Certainly, I know for the police, it causes some horrendous problems for them historically. And I think they're starting to learn now. Historically, the police have been pretty bad at dealing with the press and communicating with them. I think there's been a level of suspicion.
The thing about journalism when it comes to the police is that journalists are actually very predictable, or have been very predictable up to now. You know that thing with the police, that the police are always second on the scene. So the incident happens, they call the emergency services, the police arrive. The third on the scene, an hour later, are the journalists. So the journalists, it's one of those weird things. People say, oh, you know, what big stories have you been at? And I, at? Like, yeah, what have you seen? Like, nothing. In 40 years of journalism, I've never been at a story when it happened. I've always been afterwards. And that's always been the case. Of course, what's happened now with the citizen journalism and the rise of everyone being able to create content and film things is that that gap of 2 hours has disappeared. So now there are people on the scene filming things before the police arrive. And that's a real change. The only thing that I can say is that, as I say, that journalists are fairly predictable. Citizen journalists and members of the public, probably less predictable. But they are pretty rubbish at filming it. I mean, I am staggered by the fact that I keep thinking that people all know how to film something. They don't. And they really don't know how to hold a camera still. They don't know how to, you know, record something. They don't know how to ask a question of somebody. People will film things and it will be rubbish footage, which is why you don't see that many sort of like that. We call it user-generated content, which is, you know, content that is created by the public and then sent into the broadcasters. So that makes me think that the people that are there, the citizen journalists that are causing the trouble, they'd be causing the trouble to the police and the emergency services anyway, without mobile phones. It's not the mobile phones, it's not the technology that's causing the problem, it's helped it, but they were going to cause trouble one way or another anyway. I remember doing being sent to a shooting in Moss Side in Manchester, and there was a gaggle of reporters around the police officer who, frankly, was giving a pretty dire update, very bland, very much out of date. And one of the journalists suddenly said, yeah, but what are you going to do about the fact that there were another three officers kicking down the door around the corner at the same time that this was happening in the park over there? Don't you think the two were linked? And we didn't know about this. And the police, by the way that the police officer looked, he didn't know anything about this either. And it wasn't a journalist who was asking it. It was just a member of the public. There is a danger that traditional journalists always play by the rules, and that's not great for anybody. You know, sometimes it does need somebody to say, but hang on, there's the emperor and they haven't got any clothes on at all. Mm-hmm. And that is needed. And it's difficult, and that's a learning exercise for the emergency services. It's a learning exercise for authorities in any walk of life.
With everything that's going on in America at the moment, but I think our American cousins in law enforcement are generally very good with dealing with the media and actually use the media as part of their strategy, I suppose, yeah, when they've got a live incident.
Yeah, it happens around the world. I remember in 2015 at the Paris terrorist attacks. In the UK, I know because I've been at terrorist incidents in the UK as well. There was a tendency to put a cordon up, seal the area off, come back the next day with forensic teams, another couple of days of forensic work, clear the area up, release the blue tape, and then the community could start to get back in. In France, in Paris, the forensic teams were called almost as soon as an incident had happened. They were there, they worked through the night. 9 o'clock the next morning, the blue tape was gone. And things started to get back to normal. And you don't then have a gaggle of reporters standing at a piece of blue plastic tape 300 metres away, trying to remember or trying to guess what the heck has happened because nobody's telling them anything. It is a really difficult calculation. And I don't think anybody thinks that it's easy. It must, the flow of information when an incident is happening, it's never all straightforward. And I think that, you know, that must be really, really difficult. And I think that one of the things is that sometimes perhaps the police and the emergency services could open up a bit about that and explain why it is the whole picture is not known immediately. And I think that in general, a little bit more openness from everyone would perhaps stop some of the lunacy that's going on at the moment.
Just before we move on, I think one of my biggest worries at the moment is artificial intelligence. It's not there yet, but by God, it's close. And do we get into a position of where news is artificially generated. And I'm just thinking that
right, so,
the other day with West Midlands Police.
Funny you should say that. Right, so one of the things that I'm working on at the moment is to look at ways to counteract the rise of, I'll call it AI slop, and the false and the artifice that's created by AI. I saw some of the Iran riots.
Mm.
That there was lots that was artificially generated there, and you know, and a lot of mistruths were coming out. I actually think that AI is the saving grace of organisations like the BBC and Sky and the legacy media. I think that it's AI will save those organisations, because the only people that you will be able to trust are the ones that you've heard of before, because you daren't trust. You will get to a point where we do not trust a source that we don't know who they are. And so what you then have is more trust in those organisations that you have heard of. The fact that, you know, there is a correspondent there that you've seen before on the television, and there they are live, standing next to the blue tape or whatever, talking away. You can't AI that. One of the there's some research done by Reuters last year, which shows that live broadcasts are the most trustworthy thing, or the most trusted thing. And the reason for that is not because the reporter's there, not because the reporter is absolutely wonderful and knows everything. It's that they're human. And sometimes they make mistakes, and sometimes they and they and they stop and they stutter. And AI cannot do that. AI can't make a mistake by mistake. I mean, it does make mistakes, but it can't pause and repeat themselves and pause and repeat themselves. It can't do that. And so what you have is the very humanity of somebody standing there broadcasting live from an event is the thing that only live broadcasters can do. And there are various organisations around the world that are looking at this and saying, OK, right, do we need to put a clock, a bit like a nurse's watch, on somebody so that anybody watching it can actually see the time on that and know that that person there on the television at that moment is live and broadcast, a bit like the modern day equivalent of holding up a newspaper with today's date on it. I very strongly think that the way that we should progress and we should try and rebuild that trust in the media is by being live and using correspondents that you've seen, people that you know and you trust that what they're doing is real and is actually happening. One of the problems with packaged items on the news bulletins, you know, the type of things that's on the 10 o'clock news, is that they are so polished now that they could be AI themselves, because the editing techniques are so brilliant. The graphics are so fantastic. If you ever go back, if you ever have a chance, if you look on YouTube at The Day Today, which was a program probably about 15 years ago, maybe even 20 years ago, and it was designed, it was full of graphics, and it was at the launch of TV graphics, and it was a fake news program. And if you look at that, and then you look at some of the stuff that's going out now, they are very, very similar. And I remember one of the people who was involved in it saying that they wanted to stop doing it because they realised that what they did, the TV networks would do 6 months later down the line for real.
Yeah, that's a good point you make. I mean, you talk about trust of broadcasters. I mean, thinking about the Panorama program recently with regarding President Trump, and it was literally just they had failed to put a flash frame between the edits, literally. But the amount of criticism that the BBC got for that was quite severe, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the BBC always gets criticised, always has been and always will be. And in some ways, if it is getting criticised, the old argument is if it's getting criticised by one side and it's also getting criticised by the other side, then it must be doing something right. You know, I will, till the day I die, defend the BBC. I think the BBC is an amazing thing. One of the interesting things, right, people always say to me, ah, yeah, but what about the corporate line? What about the production and, you know, the fact that you all give the same line? In 40 years of working at the BBC, I was never told what to say once. I was never told what line to take on a story, what element to take on a story, what element to push and what element to drop down. I was never told to have a view from the BBC's point of view. It was always what I saw. And that's it. That's why you need reporters. You need reporters with eyes and with ears who actually hear and see things and then tell other people about it. It is, if you think about it, all reporters are just gossips. That's all they are. They hear something, or they look through their net curtains, they see something outside, and then they tell other people about it. I have never created a story from nothing. A story is always given to me, and I then pass it on. And that's all that happens. That's all that news is.
Well, you've mentioned that you've been a journalist for over 40 years, and really, this is probably the main part of this podcast, really, is that you will have seen some pretty difficult things to view or experience, just as I have in the police. And I'm wondering how that has affected your own well-being.
2015 was probably the biggest year of my career. So in 2015, it started with the Paris attacks, the Charlie Hebdo attack. And then I went to Malta because a boat carrying migrants or refugees coming from, I think, North Africa had sunk off. And there were 800 people had died on the boat. And, you know, I think half a dozen bodies were found. And I think that was it. It was absolutely horrendous. I came home from that, landed at Manchester Airport, was handed a bag, and then went off to Nepal because there was the earthquake, because there was an aid flight flying, leaving out of Manchester, and I managed to get on that flight. So I didn't even come out of the airport, and I just went straight off. From that, about a couple of weeks later after that, there was the Tunisian attack on the beach at Sousse. From that, I think there was... there were another couple of incidents. I was involved in sort of like tracking refugees through Europe because we were looking at the routes that they take. So I was working in Hungary and in Bulgaria, and I was working there for quite a long time. I went back to Nepal 6 months after the earthquake to go and see what had happened, and went back to the same areas. And, you know, that was probably the most startling imagery and experiences that I had as a journalist. And then at the end of the year, there were the terrorist attacks on the Bataclan and the cafes around Paris. So in 1 year, it was just crazy. As an opportunity, as a journalist, as a professional journalist, it was brilliant because I could go to all these places and see all these things. As a human being and as me, it was devastating because... The BBC does very, very good training, but the training that it does is working in hostile environments. Now, Paris is not a hostile environment. Sousse in Tunisia is not a hostile environment. They, at the moments when those things happen, they are dangerous environments, but they are not war zones, even though, you know, as I say, the things that are happening at that moment are. But the BBC's training is very much on how to operate and things like that, and how to carry on working, and about combat first aid and things like that. There's not an awful lot in preparation work that they can do, that they could do, nobody can do it, for what you will see. So there's no preparation work for being in Nepal and going through a village which has been flattened and realising that there are people who have died who are underneath the rubble that you're walking on. And how does it affect you? I remember coming back from, I think it was the second trip to Nepal, and I spoke to the BBC's team that look after your mental health. After the event, they are brilliant in terms of the planning that they have in terms of checking for post-traumatic stress disorder and just checking that you're okay. And it's there 24 hours a day. You can phone up and there are very, very highly trained people ready to talk to you. And I spoke to one of them. I spoke to the leader of the team. And she said to me, what effects are you having? And I said, well, you know, I'm having trouble sleeping. Okay. And she said, are you having bad dreams? And I said, yeah, I am. I am having, you know, bad dreams. It's 2 weeks since I've been back and I'm having bad dreams. And she said, you're sweating. Yeah, I am sweating as well about it. And she said, well, tell me some of the things that you saw. And I told her about some of the things. She said, well, if you weren't sweating and you weren't having bad dreams and you weren't having trouble sleeping, then I'd be really worried about you. Go through the experience. After a month or so, things will improve. Things will get better. You will disassociate yourself from the event that you saw and that you will move on. And she was absolutely right. Now, there are people, in some ways, the ones that are the most problematic and have most trouble are the ones that either disassociate themselves from it at the time, so they're not affected by what they see. And we're talking very, very small numbers in journalism in general that do this. But I don't think that, you know, there is a danger that everyone goes, oh, I've got PTSD after that. It's not. It's the fact that this is a very, very disturbing thing that you have seen or been witness to. And it should disturb you. And there are people, there are lots and lots of ways that that journalists cope with it. And it's, we're lucky in terms of normally a story happens, a big story, something that is upsetting, will probably only happen once a year. Once every couple of years. To some journalists, it'll never happen at all. They'll never actually see anything. They might see a road collision. They might see something like that, but they won't be up very up close to it. And so most of the time, journalists don't see it. I think that there are sometimes, there's a secondary trauma that goes on from seeing things further down the line. So court cases. There's a habit at the moment that seems to be cropping up in police forces where they try to shock the journalists a little bit. And I'm not going to go into too many details because it's only just happened, but there was one incident that happened fairly recently where there was a news conference and they said, okay, we're going off the record now. So no cameras on, no recorders on. We're going to show you the whole of the incident on from the CCTV footage. And they showed it all and it was horrific. And the people who were in the room didn't know when they went into that room that they were going to be shown that. And guess what? You know, it didn't go well. And so, you know, again, it's about that communication and about sort of like signposting what's about to happen. And I know that that's happened in a couple of stories. And I know why they're doing it. I know why the police forces are doing it, because they need to make sure that the journalists are aware of what's happened, because some things are absolutely terrible and they do need to see them. But it's just about the way that message is put forward.
Do you know, that happens quite a lot in court. I remember a family liaison officer for a gentleman who had been killed in a road traffic collision, and his family were there. Part of my role is to support the family, and speaking with the prosecutor and the defence, actually, just asking, is there any material that's going to be coming up? Because clearly the jury need to see it. That isn't the issue. But can you please warn me if anything like that is coming up so I can mention it to the family? If they don't want to view it, they can leave. That never happened. And then graphic photographs came out of the injuries to the deceased person. And you can only imagine the effect that that had. So it does go on across the board, really.
Yeah. And it's not done on purpose. Nobody's doing it on purpose.
Just like a thought,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. So I've got a friend who is a journalist and has had to cover an awful lot of court cases in the last year or so that have been pretty damn miserable. Mm. Because guess what? Media, it's not brain surgery. The media is only interested in tragic stories or stories that prove a difference. Either they're fantastic and funny or they're absolutely terrible and tragic. And most of the stories that are in court are terrible and tragic. And so the way that they are dealing with seeing this and coping with it is they are now breaking and having holiday breaks and timing their holidays according to what the news cycle is. So they know that they've got three court cases coming up, and that at the end of that, they're going to be fairly screwed up at the end of it because they know they're terrible cases. And so a booking leave off at the end of that. So, and that has implications then for their families, because suddenly what you've got is you've got one person who was party to this and saw this. They're basically timing their family's holidays just because of that event. So, you know, there's an example of it actually coming back and having a wider effect on a whole family as a result of it. I remember going back to Nepal, the only time that I had anything like a long-term effect was at Nepal. And I remember my wife telling me that she knew I was okay after about a month. I said, why am I okay now? Why wasn't I okay last week? I think I was okay last week. She said, no, you weren't okay last week. I said, how do you mean? What are you talking about? She said, well, every time we'd rowed, and there'd been a few more rows because I'd been short-tempered, and every time I'd rowed, I'd gone and stood in the doorway to the kitchen, in the door frame of the kitchen, and I'd had a row. And she'd had a talk about it, and she'd talked to somebody that she knew. And the thinking was, and I don't know if it's utterly true, but the thinking was is that in an earthquake, and had been when I was in Nepal, there were over 100 earthquakes while I was there, the strongest place to stand is in a doorframe because the doorframe won't come down. And so to bolster my strength and my position, I would walk over, stand in the doorway, have the row with her, and then walk away. And when I stopped walking, standing in the doorframe, she knew I was okay.
That's something to think about,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. It was about how I, you know, and if you extrapolate that out, it's like, you know, a bloke standing up to someone and they're putting their shoulders back and, you know, starting to confront. And when you don't confront, that's actually when the communication's going on. And that's when you're back to, is it normal? Whatever. Back to where the way you were beforehand.
So finally, for people that are listening to this podcast and they're thinking about going down the journalist route, what, any advice for them?
It's very, very difficult at the moment. I think that what is happening in the industry is that there are jobs. People say, oh, there are no jobs in media. There are jobs. They're not paying very much at all. I think that if I had any advice for anyone who wants to go into it, I think that you have to have a unique selling point. It's not enough to say now, I'm going to be a reporter, a general reporter. That's all I am. I'm not a specialist. I don't have any specialist knowledge. I did tend to do an awful lot of terrorist attacks and serious crimes, but that was just because they were things that interested me, really. So I am a general reporter. I could be sent out to go and do pancake throwing one day, or I could be out on a murder the next day. It just depended completely on whatever happened in the news. But I think that if you want to have a career in news now, you have to be a specialist in something. You have to be the very best reporter that could be at hockey or ice hockey or business news, or not even just a business reporter. You need to be specialist in one particular. So it might be commercial, or it might be in the restaurant trade. Or you might be a journalist who's, you know, a technology journalist or anything at all, but you have to have an interest. So that means that you have to have some knowledge and some interest in something else that people want to know about. There is no point at all in being I'm looking at your fish tank over here. There's no point at all in being the world's greatest fish tank reporter, because there is nobody in the general world that wants to hear about that every single day. Whereas if you were a crime reporter and you knew police officers and you knew how the justice system works, that's a real selling point. There are people who move into specialists through their careers. There's some brilliant people at the BBC who have changed laws as a result of the work that they've done. They've changed the world as a result of, you know, we're getting reporting now in family courts as a result of some of the work that some of my colleagues have done to try and force that through. And it's working really, really well.
Well, Nick, it's been a fascinating insight into a subject that we see every day, but know very little about, I suspect. So Nick Garnett, thank you very much.
DCT Audio. The art of good listening.